Welcome to PRN's Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is John Cozy. We'll discuss three topics today. I really have two, but I divide the second one into two segments. It really involves things that I've written a number of articles about. John always comes on with one or more important articles to discuss on the program, and he always chooses interesting titles. John, I love your titles. I'm not going to try to pronounce the Latin that you've got in the third line of your article, but you call your latest article "Economic Man and the Virginia White-tailed Deer." Now, I don't think anyone else has used a title like that, John.
Nobody else would write a piece like that.
And especially put the Latin in for a white-tailed deer, which I certainly wouldn't have thought about and probably never would have looked up.
Oh, well, you know, we crazy retired professors don't have anything else to do.
Oh, well, I love to throw in a few things in my articles that, you know, things strike you. They often strike me in the rewrites. You probably write articles the way I do. You write a first draft, and then you go back and you review it and you edit it, and you spot stuff that you wish you said, and then you add it on the rewrite, and you rewrite some stuff that you wrote. And that's the way it works for me. And sometimes some of my best ideas come in the rewrite.
Oh, yeah, that's the way it works for everybody. No initial piece is a masterpiece.
Absolutely. I'm certain it wasn't for Mozart or Haydn or Beethoven, so it sure as hell isn't for me.
Yeah.
It looks so easy. When somebody reads an article, John, whether it's yours, mine, or anybody else's, and if it happens to be one they like, it looks like, you know, they just rattle it off. I think older people of our generation remember movies, black and white movies, where a newspaper reporter would be on site covering a story, and he'd get on a telephone, one of these old telephones you don't see anymore, and I mean, I certainly remember them from my upbringing. He'd get on the phone to his newsroom, get the whatever they call the editor who would take down the story, and just literally rattle off a story verbatim. They would go right to key setting, to press, to come out in the latest edition. Well, writing doesn't work that way for mere mortals, John. It certainly doesn't for me.
You know, I once knew a newsman who could do that when I worked in Congress. Daniel Shore, I don't remember, you know, if you remember him or not.
Oh, I remember him. CBS and National Public Radio.
He could sit in a hearing for 2 hours, and when the hearing was over, rattle off almost a perfect summary of what happened.
Oh my goodness, I couldn't do it.
No, I couldn't do it either. I don't know how he did it, but he did it. He did it over and over and over again. I used to listen to him in awe.
Well, I do remember him very well. I think of less his TV days and more his National Public Radio days. And he passed away at least a few years ago. I think he was well up in years, but he's no longer with us now.
No, well, I'm not sure I'm still with us.
I think he kind of lost it along the way, John. He may have had the ability to rattle off a story like the old movies, but his ideas really went off the track. The ones I remember were at NPR, where he used to have I think it was on a Saturday program. He would have a weekly commentary, and you could listen to it, or you could get it online. And the stuff that he said compared to the stuff that you write and I write, John, pretty opposite on whatever subjects he decided to write on. But that's the way the dirty game is played. I mean, if you're on CBS,
that's what members of the elite do, in not only this society but other societies too. I mean,
absolutely. I mean, that is the way the game is played, and if somebody diverges from what is expected of them to do, then they will very quickly be looking for another line of work. And maybe the closest who survived a very long time was Walter Cronkite, in terms of his reporting about the Vietnam War, because he did the kind of reporting that I remember on television that is absolutely impossible today, as you simply don't get that stuff today, but he did it. And I remember mentioning Lyndon Johnson. I think I quoted Lyndon Johnson saying that Cronkite lost the Vietnam War for America. Because
he always just told it straight that it was. You never knew what his opinion was. He wasn't interested in opinions, which made him unique among newsmen.
Absolutely. I mentioned on this program before, John, that after he retired, I tried to get him on this program, but I tried too late. He was still living. He's not now. He was still living, but he was in his 90s, and I got through to his office. CBS gave him an office that he maintained, I think, to the end, and his office simply said that he reached the point in life past age 90 where he simply wanted to relax and stay on his boat or whatever and not do any more interviews. He just gave them up, but it would have been a wonderful treat to have him on one time. I remember him so well.
Yeah, my father listened to him religiously, and my father spoke very broken English, couldn't say Cronkite. He used to say Cronkike. I'll never forget it.
Well, he wasn't perfect, but he certainly compared to the stuff that we have now, John, he certainly sounded perfect. And his type of war reporting, he wasn't on the scene. There were war correspondents that were there, and he reported what they had to say, at least reasonably accurately, enough to turn Americans very, very emphatically against the Vietnam War. But that's strictly verboten today. Let's switch and talk about economic man, John. You can bring in as much of the Virginia white-tailed deer as you like, but let's talk about economic men.
Okay, the piece was germinated one day when I was asking myself the question, how come that of all the living creatures on the earth, only man has an economy? That, you look at things in nature, they don't have economies. They don't worry about economics. I mean, there's no such thing as economy for a lion or an elephant or anything. And I was looking around for an analogy, and the white-tailed deer took over my mind because we have them here in the area where I live, and they come in our backyard all the time. And when you think about a natural species like the white-tailed deer, they're solely creatures of nature. They're born in nature, they survive in nature, they die in nature, they reproduce in nature. You know, they have to worry about natural events like storms and earthquakes and fires and that sort of thing, but they don't worry about what the other deer are doing. And I thought to myself, well, now look at, how different it is for man. And why is that the case? And it occurred to me that, well, what mankind did was withdraw from nature. That's what civilization is. It's living in cities. It's a withdrawal from nature. When man discovered that he could grow plants and graze animals, he realized he no longer had to forage and hunt. So nature became irrelevant to him as life source. Primitive villages, of course, always had gardens and grazing areas known as commons where animals could, people could graze animals. But as cities became bigger and bigger and bigger, the grazing areas and the gardens began to disappear. And man became totally dependent, not on his own resources, but on the actions of others. A man in a city, if he doesn't have access to the woods somewhere where he can forage and hunt and fish and that sort of thing, can't do anything but ask others for help. I'm waking Steele, of course, but that you know, that's beside the point. When you think about it, economists don't recognize this, but economics, as we know it, it's all about the attitudes that human beings have to certain conditions in life that we call economic. And I quoted Feldstein and Roach, two economists in the Ivy League, about what they said about, you know, how the economy would be in 2014. And Root says that it's not going to do much. We're all that Americans are still trying to save their money, and Feldstein says that the stock market and home prices have given consumers confidence to go out and spend more. Well, both of those assertions aren't about the world, aren't about, you know, nature, aren't about anything real. They're about people's attitudes. Roach feels that their attitudes go one way, and Feldstein thinks that their attitudes go another way, completely opposite. These are two prominent economic, quote, scientists, unquote. It's like, you know, and that doesn't happen in any other science that we know of, even in any other academic discipline that's really focused on telling the truth about anything. And I pointed out that, you know, they both could be right. That is, if Feldstein had said that frugal people are saving and prodigal people are spending, you know, they could both be right. Could be both be spending. People could be spending and saving at the same time. But they don't say that. They don't understand man as a complicated creature. He's an artificial being that really doesn't exist. Economic man is an artificial being that really doesn't exist. I mean, there is when an economist says that consumers are confident to buy, does that really mean that they're going to do any buying? I mean, there's nothing that constrains consumers to do anything because an economist says so, or even because conditions are so-and-so. And so economics turns out to be a kind of armchair psychology where people sitting in their offices in armchairs or whatever, you know, trying to devise what people are going to do, and that is an impossible task. People do not act in a homogeneous way. I even quoted Keynes as having said that somewhere.
Well, John, Thomas Carlyle, a 19th century historian, called economics the dismal science.
Well, yeah, it's
and,
a dismal science.
And very modern-day, alive and breathing and well today economist Michael Hudson refers to the type of economics put out by people like Feldstein. Roach, I think, is a little more honest, but Feldstein and like-minded people, he refers to their brand of economics as junk economics.
Well, all economics is junk economics because it's not about anything real. It's about people's attitudes. And people's attitudes go talk to some people and find out how different their attitudes are, even when they're relatively the same.
So in the idea that home prices are going up or stock market is going up, ordinary people, a lot of the ordinary people already lost their homes, so they don't even have them. Others are struggling with a mortgage that they may have a hard time paying for if they still have a home. And as far as the stock market goes, if any ordinary people have money in the stock market, it's pennies, it's crumbs compared to the big boys who are making all the money. Something like 95 or 97% of all the gains made made in equities and basically the economic gains have gone to America's rich, mostly to the super rich.
Well, yeah. I mean, that's the point that I was trying to make, that, you know, you're not talking about anything but people's attitudes. And if you want to talk about the stock market, you have to be, you really need to be more specific. I gave an example in there, something like, if we knew that stupid people were investing in the stock market and wise people were selling out, that would tell us a great deal. But no economist can ever tell us that. You know,
whatever they may know along those lines, John, they don't say any more than they have to. There are always insiders who are buying and who are selling. When they buy, it's because they expect the stock prices to go up. When insiders like corporate CEOs sell, sometimes it isn't necessarily because they think prices will go down. It's because they've cashed in handsomely, and they simply want to stick a little money someplace else. Or used for another purpose or whatever, so that could be a motivation for selling. It could also be a motivation that things have gotten a little bit overextended, maybe a great deal overextended, and they want nothing more to do with it. Well, they can't just dump all their company stock. That would not look good. So, you know, they'll sell a portion or something or other. But the behavior of ordinary people is entirely different from the rich, the well-born,
the behavior of ordinary people. I mean, and somebody tells some ordinary people that he can get them 10% on investment, and they do it, and they find out that he's taken their life savings, and fraud happens all the time. But you know, all people don't fall for it. And the way economists talk about people and the economy, everybody is bound in their minds to act in a certain way. And that never happens. And that's the major reason that economics, as we know it today, doesn't tell us anything about anything.
Oh, absolutely, John. And I think on top of that, and I've written about this, and I've quoted others who know much more about it than I do, that so much of the data coming out of Washington is manipulated. The formula to calculate things like GDP and inflation and the employment report every month, other reports that come out, they're calculated so differently than they were many years ago. But if you look at the way they were calculated in the 1980s compared to today, polar opposites. You get completely different types of reporting than you do now.
I give an example of that. You see, economists have a way, well, every statistician has a way of manipulating data. And my point about the workforce, how the workforce is defined, those people who are employed or who are unemployed but actively seeking employment, sounded good. It must have sounded good to some economist. I don't know. I could never figure out why. But I pointed out that I pointed to an analog. What if a school system superintendent said the student body consists of only those students who study?
Yes.
You know, I mean, we would laugh at him.
You'd laugh, indeed. You'd laugh. But
somehow or other, we don't laugh at economists when they, come up with these absurd definitions.
Well, John, maybe the most stunning economic statistics I ran across was, America has, 310, 20, 30 million people. There is something on the order of 100 million Americans who are able to work age-wise. I don't know that they're all physically or emotionally able, but able to work in terms of their age category. They're not young kids, and they're not retirees. 100 million in that category who are not working because they can't find jobs. And there are 10 million more in this category today that when Obama took office in January 2009, and he has the audacity to call himself a jobs creator. He's a jobs destroyer, not a jobs creator.
Well, again, that is one of the basic points of the analogy. You know, a white-tailed deer doesn't have to depend on some other white-tailed deer to get his bread and butter. But a human being, if he loses his job, does. you know, we all have to depend upon other human beings for our bread and butter. How did John Donne put it? No man is an island, kind of,
yes,
kind of thing. But you know, a white-tailed deer is an island. I mean, he mates and stuff like that, but he can go off on his own and not worry about what the others are doing. But you and I and no other human being can. When all these this million people without jobs, you know, they're stuck without jobs because the economy requires that somebody in the economy who has the resources to be a job creator creates jobs for them. But people, you know, are unwilling to do that. It's not reliable. Consequently, this whole structure, this whole artificial structure called an economy, does not work. It collapses. It's a joke.
Indeed so, John. I guess there are millions of species. I don't know that anyone knows exactly how many there are, because new ones keep getting discovered from time to time. But I imagine there are millions, and humans are the only species, as you say, need to rely on others to accomplish their basics in life. Yeah. You know, if a white-tailed deer gets sick, it doesn't run to the white-tailed deer hospital to get treated.
No. And, you know, he doesn't have to depend upon that either. He knows, you know, it's the way things go. Now, you know, life in nature for a white-tailed deer is not easy. And if civilization, the artifice called civilization, worked, it would have made life easier for human beings, easier and better for human beings. But it hasn't done it. That's because the relationships between men that economists are hot and bothered about defining simply don't come true.
Indeed not, John. And I guess humans many years ago, and indigenous people today, I think in parts of the world, they rely on each other, unlike deer or other non-human species. But a lot of them work cooperatively together to help their society, whether it's a big one or a smaller one, really survive together. And I remember reading years ago a book titled Indian Givers, a play on words. The expression Indian Giver that most people recognize as somebody who gives something and takes it away. But Indian Givers, in terms of American Indians, indigenous societies, many, many years ago, before any Western people ever arrived in what's called America, these people created societies that handed down wonderful things that they began, including herbs for healing and rules to run societies, and their wonderful traditions were handed down and meant so much to developing America. Alone to developing America. And Benjamin Franklin, I think, studied the Iroquois in the Northeast, in New York, I believe, and wanted America's Constitution based on the way they structured their rules. And I think some things were built into the U.S. Constitution, but not as much as Benjamin Franklin wanted. And he was too old at the time to really influence what went on in Philadelphia. He was there, but he was in his 80s, so he really was not one of America's founding fathers. He was really the grand old man in Philadelphia. But he was very impressed with what I believe it was the Iroquois. I believe he was very, very impressed with their society and literally wanted America modern. After what they did, got a little bit of it, but not enough.
Yeah, well, you know, that still goes on in places in the Amazon and things. I mean, you know, human beings living in villages are different than human beings living in cities. I mean, human beings living in villages can if they want to walk out into the woods, but you know, but they can also, you know, till their own gardens and graze their own local cattle and stuff of that sort. You can't do that in Chicago.
No.
You know, you can't do it. So, you know, if things go bad for nature in a village, the people can get together and share and do stuff and work at their gardens and create, you know, protect their animals and even create storehouses that the Egyptians did for crops and stuff. But you can't do it in Chicago. Can't do it in Los Angeles. Can't do it in New York. Can't do it anywhere in a civilized society, what's called a civilized society.
And, John, in terms of the people who run America and make the policy, the policies are really all take and as minimal amount of give back as possible. And I do want to segue to the other two topics, and we can spend the rest of the program discussing them. We'll take a break in a couple of minutes. But these obsess me because American policies, in my mind, are literally based on exploiting other people, including Americans, exploiting ordinary Americans to pay them as little as possible, give them the rottenest jobs as possible, get as much productivity out of them as possible.
Where are the economic models that explain that?
Oh.
that's real economics. And where are the economic models that explain that? If people will try to explain, why spending, consumer spending goes up or down. But why won't they try to explain exploitation as an economic model?
It's a nasty word, John, that nobody really wants to bring up in polite conversation.
Nobody wants to do it because, economists are part and parcel of the political economy. They're politicians just as well as Obama is.
Oh, indeed, John.
They live this system based upon self-interest. They never bother to think of what makes human beings different than the white-tailed deer. If any of them had it, they would have known it a long time ago.
Oh, indeed. I want to focus on what's going on abroad, but as far as what's going on in America, we're both old enough to remember when Motown really meant something. It was the industrial capital of America. Pittsburgh was the steel capital of the world. Well, Detroit was the auto capital of the world. I mean, there were wonderful jobs. I mean, people could be trained, didn't have a college degree. They could make a decent income. They could buy a home. They could have a car or two when everything was enforced. They could send their kids to college when that was affordable. Well, I worked in Pittsburgh. When I came out of graduate school, I spent a couple of years at Jones and Laughlin Steel at a time when Alan Greenspan, of all people, was the economic advisor to J&L's board of directors. And in my section, which did marketing research, our section was literally off of the boardroom. And once a month, the members of the board would traipse in. And I didn't know who Alan Greenspan was from a hole in the wall, but he traipsed in with the rest of them and then have their meeting behind closed doors. And finally, he went out of business because he was a second-rate economist, and he certainly was a second-rate Fed chairman. In turn, other than being able to steal from the poor and give to the rich, and I certainly wrote a lot about that. What the America that you and I grew up in, John, back in those days, in the 50s and the 60s, I began my formal working life in 1960. I got out of grad school in February that year and went to work and spent half a dozen years or so doing marketing research before I got into small family business. There were real jobs around then. I mean, good paying jobs, good benefits. I think I mentioned once on this program that I also worked for a Goodrich Tire Company doing marketing research. And I'll never forget my first day on the job when my boss called me into his office and said, "Steve, you're doing such a wonderful job. I want to give you a raise." It turned out that literally the first day I was there was an automatic annual cost of living increase for everybody in the company, from the newest, lowliest production worker, a newest, lowliest market researcher like me, to the president, to the CEO, to the chairman of the board. And I got something like, I don't know what the percentage was, 3%, 4%, 5% the wage increase automatically on day one. I said, "Gee, this is wonderful. If we could do this every day, I'd be rich." Well, it didn't work out that way. But all that is gone now, completely gone, including the good jobs. We'll segue to go overseas when we come back. We'll take a short break.
You're listening listening to PRN, the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Peter Roth, host of Energy Stew, Saturdays at noon Eastern Time. How are the struggles of life affecting the health of your mind and body? When the flow of energy gets congested, we lose so many opportunities for happiness. This week, I'll be speaking with the shaman, Ben Ufana, and we'll discuss methods of clearing energy congestion. Be sure to tune in to Energy Stew, Saturday at noon.
Why would anyone ride on top of an elevator, lug around an 11-pound large print dictionary, or compete in a swim race unable to see the course? Well, this is me, and I've got some riveting experiences to share with you. Hey, I'm Mark Farrell. Join me for Insight, a new show coming to PRN.FM. It's about overcoming adversity, and who doesn't experience this in some capacity? I'm no doctor, but I'm an expert in me since I've been dealing with various forms of adverse conditions all my life, like having a rare visual disability that challenges much of what I do. Insight, real-life issues, including mental health, anxiety, depression, suicide, drugs, and alcohol. Celebrity guests will also reveal on Insight how they overcame adversity to make it, as well as your calls on challenges you struggle with. My difference makes me stronger. That's my mantra. Listen and discover how your difference makes you stronger. Insight, Thursdays at 11 a.m. only on PRN.FM.
Radiation is killing people all over the world, including cell phone radiation, electromagnetic fields. This Saturday, we're going to talk about it at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on my show, Let's Create a Better World. I've seen many, many speakers, videos, information, top people on the issue. We have the best that I've ever seen. Barry Isaac, a co-founder of a major institution working on this issue. He'll be on Saturday, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on PRN. Make sure you listen. We're going to talk about children, the effects on them, cell phone towers, and all the terrible risks and what you can do about it.
Hello, everyone. Richard Martin here from the Wake Up Call. The so-called housing recovery is a total fraud concocted for the masses who desperately want a feel-good story they can believe. If mortgage applications are near 16-year lows, how could home prices be possibly rising as if there were a frenzy of demand? Anyone who says so is either talking their book, owns a bunch of vacant rental properties, teaches at Princeton, or gets paid to peddle Wall Street propaganda on CNBC. I'll have much more to say this coming Friday, the 14th of February, at 2 p.m. Eastern, here on PRN. Wow.
This is Mike Fader, host of The Turning Point and Occupied Territory, and you're listening to PRN.FM, your very best source for progressive programming.
Welcome back. I'm with John Cozy. Let's shift overseas, as I mentioned. I've written so much about what's going on in theaters like Syria, in Iran, in Ukraine, and in Venezuela. Venezuela now, but certainly Venezuela over the past 15 years during the tenure of Hugo Chavez and now under Nicolas Maduro. And I thought of a title. Sometimes an article is inspired because I think of a title. And I've got two other articles for tomorrow. I began and probably won't finish an article that I thought of that my working title, and I'll probably keep it, is Obama's Multiple Regime Change Fronts. And I'm referring to Syria, to Iran, to Venezuela, and to Ukraine. We're literally four venues, four countries, four Obama campaigns to get rid of a sitting government, to topple them, to replace them with what I call pro-Western stooge government, a leader and certainly a parliament that's subservient to U.S. Wishes. This is the way the dirty game goes. And lots of talks go on in Geneva. I wrote an article I called Duplicitous Geneva Diplomacy. I focused on Syria and Iran alone. This was, oh, maybe a week ago or so. And I started off by discussing Geneva. It is the well-known world diplomatic capital. It's a traditional peace talk venue, and it's been this way for over a century. My goodness, you could go back to the 19th century. You could, after World War One, it became the League of Nations home city, and the League's Palace of Nations literally remains there today, almost unchanged from the way it was back at the beginning, the early days of the 20th century. The International Committee of the Red Cross is based there. Wonderful Geneva conventions were negotiated and completed there, 19th century ones that most people don't know about. I honestly don't know very much about them because I haven't discussed them, mentioned them, I haven't discussed them. But post-World War II, the Geneva Conventions 1 through 4, subsequent protocols that supplemented them, and common articles 2 and 3 that highlight details in them. And Geneva is known as the world's tough talks choice. So it's the home to talk about Syrian peace. It's the home to negotiate Iran's nuclear program. Why there's a need for either, I don't know, because Syria certainly threatened no one. Invaders targeted Syria. I call them U.S. enlisted death squads, which is what they are. I've repeated several times in this program that anyone who calls the Syrian conflict civil doesn't know what they're talking about, or they're lying, because there's nothing civil about it. It's a foreign invasion. It was planned by Washington long before Obama became president. It was just a question of when the trigger would be pulled. There were wars planned against Iraq, against Afghanistan, against Libya, against Syria. There's one plan, Sudan. Sudan was Balkanized. There's a war planned against the North. The South was separated, and there's an internal conflict going on in the South. This is the way America operates, and I think all of these things were planned back in the 1990s. And I've said before and mentioned in articles that if I had to name one villain above all the others, it would be Paul Wolfowitz, former number two in the Defense Department under, I think, Senior Bush. Same thing in the Junior Bush administration. I don't know what he's doing now, probably planning more wars. But all these wars were well planned. After 9/11, 4 weeks after Afghanistan was attacked, the planning didn't begin the day after 9/11 or the day of 9/11. The war was planned 6 months in advance, and the trigger was 9/11, and that was well planned as well. Had nothing to do with so-called crazed Arabs. But we've got the war on Syria raging. We've had two rounds of peace talks. I'll try to summarize very briefly, John, and get you jumped in on this. About two rounds of peace talks. They began on shortly after the 22nd of January, when 40 countries got together to express their points of view. Syria literally was isolated, except for Russia and China, and maybe one or two other countries or so that were a little bit more measured in their comments. But all the others, the Western ones and the regional Arab League states, they beat up on Syria relentlessly. And Syria is literally fighting a war for survival, and I've said and I've written that if I was the president of Syria, I would do every single thing that Bashar Assad is doing now. If your country is invaded, you have a responsibility to protect your people, to fight the invaders and get rid of them. Just imagine something like this happening in America. Well, it did happen in America. We had what's called the Revolutionary War, a little bit different playing out than the way history tells it, but basically, you know, the Brits came over here, and George Washington and the Delaware and all the rest of it. I mean, the Americans weren't going to sit around and let Britain just maul them to death. Well, this is what's happening in Syria. But Assad gets blamed for the crimes that these death squads, funded, armed, trained, directed by America, Saudi money, Qatari money, Israeli money and weapons. It goes on and on. Other NATO countries, you got to fight back against this, or your country will be mauled and completely destroyed. The terrible damage done to Syria. The Iran situation. Everybody knows that Iran's nuclear program is peaceful. peaceful. Annual U.S. intelligence assessments say so. I just wrote a week or so ago about the latest intelligence assessment, basically saying the same thing. IAEA inspectors basically say the same thing. So the power people in Washington know it, and yet they claim otherwise, and sanctions keep being piled on. They're illegal, but you know, when America does it, America does whatever it wants. Rules of law are for other people. America makes its own rules. So we've got an interim agreement with Iran, negotiated, completed last November 24th. 6 months to come up with a final agreement, but the bell didn't sound until the 22nd of January. So roughly until the 22nd of July, Iran has to come to terms on a final agreement. And, you know, I can't predict the future, but my guess is that America is going to muck it all up and blame Iran for violating the terms of the interim agreement. Could that be a trigger for bombs away? Harsher sanctions? It could be a trigger for almost anything. And the idea of America attacking Iran, that literally would be suicide if it happens. We've discussed that a little bit on this program. But the possibility exists. America wants regime change. Wants regime change in Syria. Wants regime change in Ukraine. Same thing is going on in Ukraine. You know, the tactics vary. They differ a little bit. So in Ukraine, ultra-nationalists, fascists have been recruited. They, in turn, are enlisting street thugs. They're being paid to literally create violence on the streets, to occupy government buildings. It goes on and on. It began last November. If this stuff happened in Chicago, these thugs would have been mowed down. I mean, Chicago cops would have done it. And if they couldn't handle it, the National Guard would have been brought in. And if they couldn't handle it, the Marines would be brought in. And if it went far enough, they'd just shoot them down in the streets. And the U.S. media would love it, saying you got to get rid of these people. But the sitting government of Ukraine gets blamed for the crimes these people have committed. The name of the game again, regime change. Venezuela, very briefly, same thing. Chavez was targeted until he was murdered by Obama last year. Four cancer operations in 18 months couldn't save him. Four cancer operations with the best care anybody could possibly get couldn't save him. He was poisoned. He was infected with whatever. And maybe one day they'll get a final answer on what happened. But I'm absolutely convinced that Obama killed him. The current president, Nicolas Maduro, thinks he's a mocked man. Well, we periodically have violence breaking out or all sorts of things that can happen at any point in time. In 2002, there was an aborted two-day coup. There was an aborted oil management lockout. There was an aborted presidential recall election. That's in Venezuelan law. There were 4 million signatures. There could be a new election, even though a president has a six-year term. It's not a bad idea. Be sure that the signatures are legitimate. Well, Chavez went up against that. Went overwhelmingly with a 59% majority. I remember it and remember it well. Remember writing that he was reelected one time by a greater majority than any president in U.S. history since James Monroe. 1820, why James Monroe? Because he ran almost unopposed. John, I wasn't around there, John, but I've written about it. 80% of the vote he got. I don't know why he didn't get 100%. He got 80%. They were just Minnie Mouse parties against him, nothing. So basically was unopposed. George Washington, he wasn't elected. He was coronated. And the Founding Fathers wanted him to be a king. Maybe the best thing he did in his presidency, John, was he thought that was a bad idea. He thought it was a bad idea that any U.S. president should serve more than two terms. He said a president. Only Franklin Roosevelt broke the president, almost four terms. I think it was inexcusable, but America was in World War II. John, I'll let you jump in. I didn't mean to go on this long. But my point is that Obama is waging a regime change war on four fronts, besides other ones like in Somalia and Yemen and places like that, not so much regime change, but just to kind of hold things together. This is ugly stuff, John, and there's very, very little, there's nothing accurate in the U.S. media reported about this.
It's Obama in the U.S., but it's not. It's Western civilization that came out of basically England's re-examination of the Roman Empire. And the Western countries in Europe are just as complicit in all of this as Obama and Americans are. As a matter of fact, I think that, well, I can't say I think that. I suspect that a lot of our problems come from the fact that we imported two secretaries of state who were real politicians, Brzezinski and Kissinger. They can't even speak English, but they set out to reform American foreign policy and make it into what Kaiser Wilhelm Helms Germany was in the 19th century. Kerry and other people talk about when they talk about, you know, Syria against the international community. The international community, there's no international community. Syria is part of an international community, if there is one. The international community that they talk about is simply Western civilization. That's all. That constitutes the international community. And yeah, you know, we are now involved in regime change because we realized, or somebody realized some time ago, that the notion of empire had to be reformed, that you could no longer invade a country and occupy it and milk its resources. The people today have access to ways of fighting that kind of occupation that drives the occupying power out eventually and costs it an enormous amount of money, and that's what's happening in the world today. The Western civilization has gotten the idea that you don't have to invade a country and colonize it anymore. All you have to do is make its government agreeable to Western ways. And, you know, we've been trying it since the Second World War, and it has not worked. There are places when it's sort of worked, not worked, like Algeria, okay? It didn't work in Libya. Libya is a mess. We don't hear about it because it's such a mess. The tables went completely sideways in Egypt. You know, well, from something it looked like a people's revolution to a military dictatorship. It's the intervention in the Sudan, the South Sudan, creation of the South Sudan didn't work. Within weeks, they were at arms with each other. It didn't work in Iraq. Iraq is far worse off today than it was under Saddam Hussein. It didn't work in Pakistan. I mean, in Afghanistan. We're going to find ourselves having spent all that money for nothing in a couple of, in something like 8 months or 10 months or something. We're going to be out of there, and it's all going to be a waste of resources. I read today we're now trying to find drone bases to continue our attacks on Pakistan, which is supposedly a friendly nation, and we're concerned that we won't be able to get the intelligence we need to carry out continued drone strikes on Pakistan if we lose the bases in Afghanistan. I mean, this is absurd. And what Washington doesn't realize is that countries, governments, these days cannot control their peoples. That's all there is to it. You put a friendly Western government in power, and the people will reject it. At least reject some of them. So that you have this situation where we're like the drug war. America does this kind of thing. It comes up with a policy, It puts it into effect. The policy fails, so what do? We double down, do more of it. And of course, that's absurd. I'm not don't want to, you know, by any means absolve America of its part in all of this, but it's not just America. It's Britain. It's France. It's Germany. It's Italy. It's Spain. I mean, it's Portugal. They're all part of the same game. The Bilderbergers always meet somewhere over there in Holland or Switzerland or somewhere. That's where the these plans are being made. They're not being made in Washington. Why is the Council of Foreign Relations have any influence on American government? It's not a government agency. It's got nothing to do with the government, but it influences government. Why? Why? Because somebody else is controlling this whole civilization. And, you know, yeah, it's quick to say they're bankers, and I guess they are in a sense, but there's more to it than that. And I'm not privy enough to know about it, but that's what's going on.
I refer to it as the power structure, John, that it doesn't matter who sits in Congress, who occupies the Oval Office. The power, the embedded power structure runs America. Certainly Wall Street plays a major, major role. And as far as the Bilderbergers go, David Rockefeller, his nickname is the Master Spider. Well, his day is passing soon. I think he still showed up at the last meeting, but the last time I checked, he was about 97 years old, so the old guy can't last forever. But he literally, if there was one guy that could be called the most powerful person in America, it was David Rockefeller. Of course, John's, I don't know, his grandson or whatever. Powerful guy and a banker, and of course the oil interests and the rest of it. But again, this is the system. This is the system that runs America. They're the brokers who decide who'll hold the power positions in Congress, who gets to even be nominated to be, you know, two nominees to run for president. I mean, they literally pick the nominees, and they pick the winner before the election is held. And nobody gets to be a Ways and Means chairman, an Intelligence Committee chairman, an Appropriations Committee chairman, unless these guys decide that's the person they want. It's usually a man. Once in a while, it can be a woman. But again, the system runs America. They decide if there'll be war, if there'll be peace. They decide everything, and they certainly decide what benefits them.
Here's the white-tailed deer. It's all a matter of the artifice called the economy. You have to depend on people, and the people you have to depend on have bad character, and that's all there is to it. You know, the elite, the Western elite, the Bilderbergers, and everybody who goes, you know, to that kind of meeting. They're not just Americans; they're from all over the place. But they're all Westerners, and they all believe in empire, Western empire. You know, you think they'd have learned a lesson by now, but they're dumb. They're powerful, but they're dumb.
They really are dumb, John, because history is very clear. There hasn't been a single empire in human history that survived. Every single one of them went down.
Well, you know, but they're trying to get around that by making a one world empire. But they're forgetting that governments, you know, are one thing and people are another. Obama was elected and had an enormous approval rating to start off with, and he's down in the dumps. But, you know, the government can't control people. I wrote a piece somewhere one time, and I said that, you know, people don't obey the law because somebody enacts it. They obey the law until they find some good reason to disobey it. And that's all there is to it. And law enforcement isn't law enforcement. It's just an ability. It's just an activity meant to get the people who refuse to obey the law out of society. You know, it's a form of banishment. The banishment could be a bullet in the brain, but you know, basically, a prison is a place of banishment.
John, it says something about a failed system that America has by far the world's largest prison system in the world. China, four times the population, literally has fewer people incarcerated than America.
Yeah, they got fewer laws to break. I mean, the people don't realize that you know, laws are not effective on people if the people don't want to obey them.
Indeed so, John. The music means that we have run out of time.
Yeah, the fat lady is singing.
Oh, the fat lady is singing indeed. John, it's always great having you on. I look forward to more. These things will not go away. The white-tailed deer will be here, I guess, I don't know about forever, but they'll go on doing what they're doing and get along just fine. And humanoids will go along and keep killing each other and causing human misery. Something in the DNA, John. Maybe we'll talk about that in the future program. Maybe that's a good topic for you to write about. The flaws in human DNA.
I don't know enough about it.
John, many, many thanks. I look forward to the next time.